for June 11th, 2007, and we're going to start off with the federal grant application for the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. Mr. Beiler. Mr. Siebert, do you want to give us a brief overview?
Mr. Chairman of the Committee, just briefly, this is a request to submit actually four federal grants to U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's National Coastal Wetlands Conservation Grant Program. Two of the grants would be for acquisition, and two would be for restoration, and I'll let the department explain them in a little bit more detail.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Tom Beiler, the Director of the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, and at my right is Lisa Pearson with the Department of Administrative Services. As Paul explained, what you have before you is a request from OWEB to apply for federal grant funds from the National Coastal Wetlands Conservation Program administered by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. There are four proposed projects, all of them are in Lincoln County, located in the Lincoln County area. They all deal with wetland and intertidal issues. Two of the projects are restoration projects. The other two deal with acquisition of wetland areas in the Alsea Bay area and the Aquinnah Bay area. We have been working in partnership with local interests and other partners to put these projects together for applying for these federal funds, including the Midcoast Watershed Council, the Salmon Drift Creek Watershed Council, and the Wetlands Conservancy. These federal grants, if we're successful, will require 25% non-federal match. I would expect that the local proponents of these projects will come to the OWEB board as well as find some other resources to provide those non-federal match sources if that need arises down the line. The deadline for filing these applications is the end of this month, and we expect to hear from the final results from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service by the end of the calendar year. I do have Ken Beerley here of OWEB staff who can address any specific questions, or if you desire more detailed information about any of these proposals, we'd be happy to provide you that information.
Any members of the committee have any questions? Representative Garrard.
Good morning, Tom. Is anyone opposed to this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, not to my knowledge, no.
Any additional questions?
Okay. Mr. Chair, I just have a quick one.
Yes.
Tom, are all or any of these in conjunction with watershed councils as far as who's doing the restoration, or are they with other nonprofits? Or I haven't had a chance to read through this since I just got it. So.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, there's been heavy involvement with the Midcoast Watershed Council and the Salmon Drift Creek Watershed Council on the two restoration projects. The acquisition projects, I think the local lead is the Wetlands Conservancy, who's been partnering on the project.
Additional questions or comments? I'll close the public hearing, open a work session. Do we have a motion to recommend to the full Ways and Means Committee?
Mr. Chair, I recommend approval of the grant request to the full Ways and Means Committee. So do pass recommendation.
Any additional discussion? Any objections to the motion? Seeing no objections to the motion, motion passes. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Now I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3543. Mr. Siebert, do you want to take a moment to get to...
Yes. Mr. Chairman of the committee, House Bill 3543 creates a Global Warming Commission and also a Climate Change Research Institute. I believe we have a number of people signed up to testify. I'll look at the testifiers.
Do either of the chief proponents want to testify?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to say something because this had hearings in my committee and went straight to Ways and Means. So this was a bill that we had 2 days of hearings on climate change bills, both invited testimony and public testimony. And we heard from stakeholders, many industry folks. We heard from the religious community. We heard from the public. We heard from all sorts of folks in support of this bill. We heard no opposition to this bill in my committee.
And I suppose I would add, just so the committee has a little bit more background, too. This is, you know, we've had a number of different climate change, renewable energy related bills. This is the one piece remaining this session that just kind of ties up all those ends on both incorporating the university system with research, both the government and private involvement with the task force, and then setting emission standards to capture emissions that weren't captured in the other bills that we've already passed. So it's the last piece of the puzzle for us.
And Mr. Chair, I just for the record want to note that Department of Forestry did come in and ask for some amendments, and we ran out of time, so I do have a -3 amendment from that Representative Cannon actually submitted. I don't know if he gave a copy to the chair, but this was to include some of the requests that the Department of Forestry asked for, and as chief co-sponsor for that, and I actually talked to the senator about it, and so I would just make sure that that is submitted. I know we're not in work session, but I just want to make sure that folks know that we did look at the Department of Forestry's recommendation and do recommend adding that.
Okay. Well, when the bill comes back, we'll ask for an analysis of the amendments.
That's a pretty good idea what it will do.
I think there maybe are other amendments pending also for consideration. We will start off with Craig Smith. Is Mr. Smith here? And also Lisa Aldato. I think one of the tests they should give chairman is trying to read some of these names. And probably... Please start us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me here. My name is Craig Smith, and I'm the Vice President of the Northwest Food Processors Association, and I really appreciate the opportunity to speak to this bill. I'm here today to speak in favor of this bill with some amendments that we'd like to propose, a couple of issues that, again, I think we ran out of time in Representative Dingfelder's committee to really be able to deal with. We did give this testimony in the committee, but it was a pretty full day. So the two things that I'm really here to address you about today are, number one, the emission goals in this bill, which the Oregon emission target that is listed in this bill is 10% below the 1990 level in the year 2020 is the one I'm really focusing on. That would be 10% below both Washington and California's adopted goals, and we're suggesting that it might be wise for Oregon to adopt the goal that our neighbors have adopted. We're also part of that six-state now Western Regional Initiative that the governor has joined. We have been very supportive and very involved in that process, and would suggest that adopting a 2020 goal that would be equal to 1990 probably makes more sense than 10% below. It's a little bit of an accounting process that it may not be that big of a deal, but we would really encourage that amendment, and we do have an LC draft that would address that. The second issue that I'd really like to address that I think is really critically important, that no state that we're aware of has really addressed well in legislation, is the issue of adaptation. In the climate change world, there's really two major issues. One is controlling emissions, which we've been doing with a bunch of energy bills this time, and these goals that are in this bill. But the adaptation process is the process of actually surviving through climate change. And there is absolutely nothing in the bill right now that deals with adaptation. Most of the states have not adequately addressed that. And we believe that's the most critical issue. For food processors and water supply, if we don't address adaptation, we're going to be very seriously at a disadvantage. And so we have put together some language for you that we believe would include that as the mission of the commission. It would include adaptation, and it would ask the commission to come back with goals and implementation processes that will meet the adaptation requirements. We believe that is probably the most critical piece of climate change, of addressing that in the legislation. So with that, I'll stop and answer any questions if you have any.
Any questions for Mr. Smith?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Just adaptation. I mean, specifics. What would? Yeah.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Senator Nelson. Adaptation would be things like, for instance, our big concern is water supply. With climate change, we know that we're not going to have adequate snowpack. And so things like off-channel storage or new water regimes and those kinds of things that are
speaking his language.
The near and dear issues, Senator. But there are many of vector control, forest fires. You know, all what I'm speaking to are the things that happen as a result of climate change that change the way we live and do business. And for our industry, survival into the future, having an understanding that the state is working hard to keep our water supply intact is absolutely critical to investment. And that is a big issue for us. We don't want our industry to feel threatened in any way, shape, or form, that the state does not care about us enough to do the things that are going to be required. It's a huge issue, and we're willing to bear our burdens. So that's what I'm referring to when I say adaptation.
Yes, Representative Garang.
If some of these adaptations were adverse to farmers, how would you feel?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garang, I think that there is going to be a process where, I mean, we're obviously concerned about the farm community. That is our major constituency, and the people who provide crops for us to process are critically important. There will be policy decisions that will have to be addressed that are going to have to look at farming, food processing, manufacturing, city water supply, and if there's decisions to be made as to how we deal with those, I mean, we all need to be at the table to do it, and that's why we've asked for this language to be included in the bill. Because if we default, then the farm community will be the losers, because they are the least able to pay for increased water supply. So as water prices go up, if we happen to open the market up, farmers will be the ones that get hurt first, and we don't want to see that happen. We don't think that's good public policy.
Paula?
Yes.
You don't find that contradictory?
No, I don't. No, I think if we're forced to adapt to climate change, which we believe we will be, decisions will be made. And if they're made in a vacuum, then the default position is to go after farmers' water. That is just the way it works all across the West. And so the pressure.
You don't need to tell me about that.
Well, I understand, and I understand that. I have been very involved in those issues. And so what we would like to see is a situation where public policy is made that makes sense, that protects the folks who are the least able to pay.
Thank you. Representative Klein.
It's my, at least, understanding. I saw a draft of the LC amendments. My reading of them, talking about adaptation or having this group talk about adaptation in no way takes away from the efforts to reduce. It's
no.
Just acknowledging a reality that while we work on reducing, we probably need to be thinking about adapting as well.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Klein, that is absolutely correct. We are in favor of the bill in its entirety. We believe that reducing emissions is also important. But if we don't look at adaptation, we've missed a significant piece of the whole climate change deal.
The other comment I might just like to see if you concur. From my experience, starting earlier on things like, you know, low flow sprinkler heads and micro,
yes.
You know, it's better to be doing this now when it's cheaper than later. And that's how I sort of see your idea on how to help farmers is get in and do the project now while it's still relatively cheap.
Exactly.
Yes, Representative Garang.
Just a question to the chair. Just how much policy change are we going to do on this Ways and Means Committee?
Well, we are in public hearing now. The bill has not yet been scheduled for a work session. I think we will talk about potential amendments. I think it will depend upon what the... I haven't been given any restrictions at this point from the co-chairs. I think it will depend upon basically where the committee comes down and what it takes to put out a bill that has a chance for passage in both chambers.
Thank you.
Any additional questions? Thank you. Mr. Dolan.
Hello, my name is Lisa Adato, and I'm with the Oregon Business Association, and I appreciate the opportunity to come and speak before you. I'm here actually to speak on behalf of the Oregon Business Association and, in addition, one of our members, Nike. And in terms of House Bill 3543, we're coming to support this bill. I think we see here in Oregon and nationally that climate change has become a key issue for the business community, and the business community is very used to looking at both threats and opportunities, and climate change represents both. And I think the consensus is moving to the point of not should we deal with this, is this something that's important, but really just how and who. So I want to talk about two particular issues before I go to the Nike piece. One is, well, why should little Oregon get involved in this global issue? And the second has to do with the goals. The first, in terms of why Oregon, and is it important for Oregon to be involved? And to that, we would say yes. We think Oregon both can have an impact and should be involved for its own protection. First of all, in terms of how can Oregon have an impact? In a couple of ways. First of all, Oregon really is a leader in terms of thinking about sustainability. It's an early adopter state with people moving here to try new techniques because they care about these issues. And we're also a relatively collegial and small state and can get things worked out. In terms of us compared to other West Coast states, California has passed significant climate change legislation already. Oregon has not, but Oregon has developed significant climate change plans. We've had working groups in Oregon creating a cap and trade system, for example, over the last year and a half, and have worked out with major stakeholders some pretty thorny issues. So we have a design. California has a law. However, California, with their law, doesn't have a design. So because of that, Oregon has a chance to put our design and make it a real player in a regional context. And we've put together a five-state agreement. So we should put Oregon at the table. And I think we have a real opportunity to do that. And I think this, by passing the law that's before us today, that will help us move forward with this in a formal way. Now, why should we? There's also some strategic reasons that Oregon should go to the table, and those have to do with our positioning vis-a-vis other states. First of all, we are a small state. If this goes immediately to the national stage, we'll have less of a voice. So we really have an opportunity now to strategically work with the five states and get our voice to the table. There's some danger if we don't, for a couple of reasons. First of all, Oregon is a big hydro state, and we have tended to invest in sustainability early. We don't want to be in a position where where we don't get credit, basically, for our early work. And that's happened in other areas. I know in my former career when I was working with Medicare, Oregon was much more cost-effective early on than other states. And when national legislation that was a per capita payments came out, Oregon was at a real disadvantage. So I want us to be thinking strategically that we don't want to be at a disadvantage because of our sustainable practices. And so think about how important it is to get Oregon's voice at the table, and that this kind of law and really pushing for Oregon's answers would be very useful for us. There are a couple of issues that I'd want us to consider later that aren't related to this law, but as we create our approach, we want to make sure that our approach doesn't disadvantage what's traditionally been an advantage for us, and that's low electrical rates. And so we want to make sure that we do get a very comprehensive cap and trade or comprehensive climate change system in place. So for the OBA, I'd just like to say again, we support this law. We think it's very important to deal with this issue, and we believe that strategically it's important to formalize the process. Finally, in terms of goals, the goals that are in the law have been done appropriate to the science. And the science that has that has been evaluated over many, many years. I would be concerned about changing the goals, because one thing about climate change is it's somewhat unforgiving. It's based on CO2 that can be measured, and we don't want to be in a position where we're constantly setting new bars that are higher or lower. We want to set bars cleanly at the beginning that are consistent with the science. And so we believe that the goals that are in the law are consistent with the science. So that concludes my testimony on behalf of the OBA. And now I'd like to just read a statement from Nike, one of our members. And Nike, which is Oregon's only Fortune 500 company, has been a leader in sustainability and is actively engaged at the state, regional, and national and global level on climate change issues. And by the way, I worked with one of the sustainability director at Nike and participated in the climate change meetings that led to this law. Last month, Nike released its 2005-2006 corporate responsibility report, and in it, Nike set an ambitious target to make all Nike brand facilities climate neutral by 2011. Nike has exceeded its reductions targets for the last 2 years, and Nike has put years of research into new products and processes to become climate neutral. Nike supports House Bill 3543 as it views this bill as the next step in our state-level platform to take action here and at home and to work with other regions. Thank you very much.
Representative Garrard.
Mr. Smith, did you testify before the House Committee on Energy and the Environment?
Mr. Chair and Representative Garrard, I did. I did.
Thank you both. Ms. Ackerman and also Ms. Schellinger-Cross.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Gail Ackerman. I'm the director of the Institute for Natural Resources at Oregon State University and also a special advisor to the Vice President for Research. I'd like to testify in support of House Bill 3543 and specifically address the importance of the Climate Change Research Institute, and that's where the fiscal impact on the bill comes from, and I'd just like to spend a couple minutes explaining what that institute will do and why it's important. As the bill indicated, it would create a new research institute, and that research institute would coordinate across the entire Oregon University system research initiatives aimed at addressing the kinds of questions that Representative Clem and Mr. Smith raised. What are the impacts of climate change likely to be on Oregon, Oregonians, on businesses, on local governments, on state governments, and what do we need to do to both adapt and mitigate in order to address those impacts? These are very difficult questions, and developing that Oregon-specific research agenda is no small task, and someone has to coordinate that because it requires interdisciplinary teams of researchers, social scientists, planners, physical scientists, agricultural scientists, and it requires very close connection with the Citizen Commission to help set that agenda of what are those highest priority research topics. Our experience within the university system with an institute like this is that we expect the institute will be able to leverage the $250,000 a year that you would invest by bringing on a 10-to-1 basis in terms of external research funding. That's the historic record of the College of Oceanic and Atmospheric Sciences at Oregon State, where this institute will be housed. And we believe that there is that kind of money available at the federal, the international, and the private foundation level, as well as through private businesses and industries and local governments who are really struggling with these questions, that we can get that kind of revenue. But somebody's got to put the time in to develop the research agenda, to define the questions, to bring the teams together, and to go after those other funds. Otherwise, there's no one there to sort of put all the pieces together. I think you've received a letter from Lorna Stickle from the Portland Water Bureau on behalf of the Regional Water Consortium in Portland. Mr. Smith also talked about the water suppliers and the difficulties that they're facing. They are not at this point able to really do refined analysis of what the implications are for providing water to Oregonians. And without this new research capacity in the Oregon University system, we are not going to be able to help them get those answers, because you have to customize the models to make them work for our specific area, and you also have to understand the specific hydrology, which varies greatly across the state, to really help do that analysis. Similarly, as many of you know, I'm a member of the Oregon Transportation Commission. We've got the same questions on our infrastructure. I, frankly, as a trustee of the Highway Fund, I want to know, where are our facilities really going to be seriously impacted by sea level rise and other storm impacts associated with climate change, so that we can make the decisions on something like Highway 35 when we rebuild it after the debris flows from last winter. We build it in a way that matches with what we know is going to be happening with the glaciers on Mount Hood, or better yet, know even more what's going to be happening with the glaciers on Mount Hood, so that the engineers can actually design the highway in a way that we won't be having to spend tens of million dollars putting it back together again another time. So I think the $250,000 that's requested to start up the Climate Change Research Institute in the second year of the biennium, it'll take us that long to do the recruiting, assuming we have the funding, is going to be money very, very well spent, and it was called for by the original Governor's Advisory Group on Global Warming. It's been called for by the Climate Change Integration Group, which has been working on this issue more recently, and I think it's absolutely essential if we're going to implement mitigation and adaptation strategies. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Yes, Representative Clint.
Question either for Gail or LFO. I concur that most of higher ed has an incredible leveraging track record, and that this should be no different. My concern is I'm looking at an A in gross bill. So you talk about if we would contribute $250,000, we could probably leverage tenfold. I'm looking at this bill, and all I see is a reference to something that was deleted somewhere else, I assume, that talks about appropriating money from the general fund to the Department of Energy and Higher Ed. And in our fiscal analysis, I see that Energy says they can absorb it internally because they're going to use the same staffing that they've used on some other sort of work group related to climate change. Higher Ed, you said it was a new program, I believe, but it looks like the money is taken out of this bill, and I'm wondering if it's appropriated elsewhere in some other budget.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there is no money for this institute in the higher education budget as passed out of the full Ways and Means Committee.
So if we pass this bill with that deletion out, we'll tell them to create a new program and provide no funding to do it. Is that accurate?
Regarding the institute, if you were to do that without providing the funding, you would in a sense, by statute, say that there should be a program, but you wouldn't have provided any funding for it. That might put the university system into a quandary, in a sense, because I don't really know if they would be obligated to have an institute if they had no funding, and maybe miss an act.
Chair Devlin, Representative Clem, if the institute is created and there isn't any funding for it, it's fair to say that the university system will continue to do what it's been doing, which is try to coordinate as best we can with the faculty and staff that we currently have, but we would not be able to step up to get the enhanced effort to focus on Oregon-specific climate change research that we would otherwise pursue in coordination with the commission, because at that point the faculty are going to be going after their traditional sources of research dollars, and that might have as much to do with the effects of climate change on the Pacific Islands as it does with the effects of climate change on Oregon and Oregon business and industry. So I think it would be fair to say that it would exist on the books, and we'd give it, no pun intended, a good college try, but it would not be providing the kind of development of a targeted research agenda to meet Oregon's needs and opportunities related to climate change that would exist if we had the funds.
Yes.
And do we have a sense of the type of faculty that would work on this? Because this would be, I mean, technically it says Department of Higher Education should create it, but do we know, would it be Oregon State that does it, and then would the faculty all have to be rearranged from their existing work over to Oregon State, or is it system-wide?
Chair Devlin, Representative Clem, it is truly going to be a system-wide effort. There are representatives from U of O, PSU, and Oregon State have been very deeply involved in putting the charge for this together. And there are a range of faculty at all institutions with real expertise to contribute, with Oregon State probably strongest, obviously, in oceanic and atmospheric sciences. But at University of Oregon, they have some very talented political scientists and economists who have worked on impacts of climate change and adaptation. At Portland State University, they have a real depth in their planning at faculty and urban design and impacts on built environments. And so there are faculty really throughout the system. The College of Forestry and the College of Agricultural Sciences at Oregon State have a lot of faculty working on these issues. So we'd be pulling teams together depending on what the questions were that this new commission would help the Institute prioritize. And then the administrative function would be at Oregon State University. And that's, your committee hasn't dealt with this, but it's exactly the same format as the University Transportation Research Center, which Congressman DeFazio was able to get funded, which is housed at Portland State, so they administer it, but faculty throughout the system participate. And, for example, Oregon Institute of Technology is a partner in the University Transportation Research Center, even though it's administered at Portland State. And although we haven't yet, we've got a person from Oregon Institute of Technology, their Renewable Energy Center is working on the Bioeconomy Sustainable Technology Signature Research Center Steering Group, and we expect Oregon Institute of Technology to be involved as well, again, through their Renewable Energy Institute.
Okay. Thank you very much. Please proceed and identify yourself for the record.
My name is Sally Schillinger Kraus, and Chair Devlin and members of the subcommittee, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I am speaking on behalf of the Oregon Environmental Council, and we support the bill as written for a number of reasons. There are a number of issues that I'd like to highlight here. And I think the first thing, as Senator Avakian first noted, this bill does a lot to tie up loose ends around several other bills that have been introduced and passed earlier in this session, namely the Renewable Energy Standard, another bill that is being looked at closely now, which is the biofuels package, some energy incentive bills. These are all recommendations from the Oregon Strategy to Reduce Greenhouse Gas Reductions. And similarly, this bill stems also from that strategy. And more than tying up loose ends, it also sets the stage for adopting new policies down the road in relation to mitigation and adaptation. And specifically, as Lisa Dotto, Gail Achterman have also noted, we're part of the five-state agreement. We're one of the first states to sign on. BC and Utah are also new states signing on. And Oregon really needs to, I think, be foremost at the table in terms of helping to set the goals. It's likely that the five-state agreement will reach some kind of aggregate of all the state goals. And with Oregon having slightly higher goals, I think it will help maintain a commitment to having science as the basis for the entire region when they do set their goals. I think this is very important. I don't think it's really upon us, incumbent upon us, to change the 1990 levels or the 10% below 1990 levels when an international body of scientists have said that this is what we need to do if we're going to make the changes in addressing climate change that we need to. So that's one thing. I would also say that in relation to the adaptation amendments, clearly this is something we need to address, not, I think, in replacement of mitigation measures, but to do alongside of mitigation measures. The Climate Change Integration Group has been looking at ways of recommending adaptation measures. We certainly see the Climate Change Institute as being a primary driver for looking at measures and looking at different policies, and we certainly support the fiscal addition, and we support that having that. I'm sorry. we support having the fiscal addition for the Climate Change Research Institute. Finally, I would just like to say that in all, when you're looking at Oregon specifically, there are a number of things that Oregon can and should do to address climate change. When you're looking at a national level, the federal government is really behind in taking significant steps to address climate change. It's really incumbent upon the states now to set policy and to set strong policy and to provide models for the regional agreement and for any other federal agreements that take place. If we set something strong, they're going to be more likely to adopt those changes later on, as opposed to going the other way and adopting something that may not be quite as advantageous to Oregon or to the western states. So we do support HB 3543. We'd like to see it move forward as written, and we'd also like to see it serve as a platform for new policies, either in the 08 session or following in the 09 session.
Representative Klein.
Just wanted to focus on something you said. Referred to an international group of scientists that have said that we should be at 1990 levels, or actually I think you just said they said this is what it should be. California and Washington ignored them, or what exactly, how did that come about? What's the timeline?
Well, our guideline or our level timeline is a little bit different than California and Washington. And I think basically we're looking specifically at science-based goals. I think Washington and California were looking more at what they felt was realistic or achievable and brought the level down slightly. I think here it's important to think about not what we think might be achievable, but what we need to do, what we should be doing in order to get carbon dioxide levels to a place of climate stabilization. That's the end goal that we're looking at. That's what we want to achieve, and that should be our guideline.
And just the body that set that you referred to, that's, I guess, I don't know what we're talking about here.
It's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And this is an intergovernmental panel of approximately 2,000 climate scientists all over the world who are really responsible for the majority of climate research that's been taking place. And they were formed back in the 80s when this issue first came to light. And they've really been responsible for moving the research forward and identifying the major places where we can expect to see impacts. They've been the ones who've been tracking the science over this period of time. And it's based on their recommendations that the original governor's advisory group based their own goals.
these target levels, which are, as I see in here, goals that do not create any additional regulatory authority, so they're really goals, not
exactly
mandates. These numbers come from their reports?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Basically, the IPCC, or the IPCC has said that we need to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions by at least 75% below 1990 levels by the year 2050. And more recently, they have suggested that even greater reductions are necessary.
So if I got it right, California actually says 80% below 1990. So they're a little tougher than we are at the end, but they're not as aggressive by 2020. Is that, you think, based on some of these additional things this group has said, or are they just picking their own number based on sort of where they want us to be versus what science said?
I think they're basing it on, again, what they feel as though they can manage. I think right now there's a debate about how much we should do right now as opposed to how much we should do later on. And our position is that the more we do now, the more stringent our goals are sooner, the easier it will be to meet the tougher overall ultimate goals down the road. And I think that's a good position to be in.
Yes, Pat, good morning. There is still a lot of controversy in regards to the basic premise of climate change. And this is probably not the greatest forum in the world to be debating this policy, as I indicated earlier, but we're kind of exposed to it this morning. Roughly, according to this letter we have from the Cascade Policy Institute, it says roughly 97% of global CO2 emissions are generated by natural causes. Oregon's emissions are insignificant in comparison. That kind of blows this whole thing apart, doesn't it?
I'm not, Representative Girard, I'm not sure, I don't know where the Cascade Policy Institute has found those numbers. If you're talking about Oregon's overall contribution to global warming, certainly in comparison to the entire nation, other countries, even California, certainly were less significant. It does not mean, though, that we should shirk our responsibilities in providing a leadership model to the rest of the world in terms of demonstrating how we can cut our emissions while at the same time maintaining a strong economy. And I think that's one of the real questions here. The other question in terms of the actual science is that carbon dioxide emissions are now at a higher level than they have been at any time over thousands of years. And that's largely due to the industrial contributions that we have made, either by transportation, electricity generation, or by a number of other releases as carbon sinks now become emission factors. So I think that global warming is no longer debated as being controversial, but the real question is how do we go about addressing it, and who is responsible for taking that leadership position. Right now, it seems to be incumbent upon the states to really show that initiative first.
So you want us to spend $250,000 on approximately 3%, despite the fact that Oregon's emissions are insignificant. You still say that this is an issue, that global warming is an issue, while with a great number of the populace of this country, it is not.
I believe that global warming is emerging as a major public concern. And certainly within the state of Oregon, we need to be very cognizant of the kinds of impacts that we can expect to see
both in terms of rising sea levels and the impacts that's going to have on Oregon's coastline, which is a major part of our economy. At the same time, as noted by Craig Smith, water levels, which are a major resource for another large sector of our economy, are expected to decline because of loss of snowpack and other drought factors. And these things we cannot ignore. So if we're looking at being able to, we may not be able to affect overall, you know, the large amount of emissions that are being produced worldwide, but we can certainly look at adaptation measures and we can be responsible for our own emissions. And I think taking that kind of responsibility shows that Oregon can really move the way forward for many other states. And if you do look at the impacts, it's not insignificant to the state in terms of our economy, industries, and people's livelihoods.
Thank you for your opinion.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Charles.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just a reminder that the House is in session.
Thank you. Okay.
If those who are going to testify could be asked to eliminate duplication of testimony, I'd certainly appreciate it.
Mr. Charles will be testifying from a different standpoint. So.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, John Charles, representing Cascade Policy Institute. I think I probably will not be duplicating anyone else's testimony here. Briefly, Mr. Chairman, since this is a budget committee, I'll try and focus on the budgetary aspects of this. I am somewhat puzzled as to why you want to create a new research institute, since there are many of them kicking around. Higher Ed, Gail Ackman runs one at OSU. In my testimony here, I list one others down at U of O, one at PSU. It seems to me that part of the bill is not necessary, that if you want the research agenda carried out, you could simply ask one of the existing institutions to do it and appropriate some money. And especially when I look at page 2 of the fiscal analysis and I see the money is going primarily office manager, office specialist, web support. There's very little in the way of policy research in those. And I look at $750,000 over 4 years. I mean, I just say I run a research center, a policy center. I have salaried people. I have freelance contract people. Just seems to me you're spending a lot of money here relative to the modest agenda of Section 15 of the bill. Now, you know, it's a judgment call. If that's the way you want to proceed, that's your business. But I personally think it'd be easier to take one of the existing institutes within higher ed, and there are many of them, and I'm sure many of the people who run them would be happy to talk to you and take the money if you wanted to just give them some money directly for, you know, 1.5 FTE or something to focus actually on the research part, because they already have office staff, they already have chairs, desks, a director. I mean, that's the way I would go. Second, I don't think there's a need for the proposed commission, sections 4 through 14, because the executive branch, the governor's already been doing a lot of this work through executive orders, et cetera, for the last 4 years. Seems to have gotten a lot done with not a whole lot of money. And so that part is, I mean, you can do it. I just don't think it's essential. My third point is that the proposed greenhouse gas reductions goals in Section 2 are unnecessary because the economy itself has been decarbonizing for over 50 years, assuming for the moment that reducing CO2 is actually desirable and will have some benefit, which may or may not be the case. The good news is, for over the last 50 years, CO2 per unit of GDP has been declining steadily. In fact, last year was the fourth largest decline since 1949. So the things that many of the proponents of this bill want are being done anyway, and carbon intensity is the only really issue that matters. Picking goals of absolute levels has a symbolic value, I guess, but it's not as if you would hold someone accountable if you fail to meet the goal. I mean, who are you going to hold accountable? So, as I point out here on page 2 of my testimony, Oregon CO2 emissions peaked in 1999. They've been declining ever since. Total energy consumption in the country, the annual peak was 204. In 05, it actually dropped. And so what happens is when you have the carbon intensity declining steadily for over 50 years, it's like slowing a big ship. Suddenly, at some point, total consumption stops and it goes down. total emissions will probably peak in the country in the next 5 years or so and go down. And you don't have to argue about goals, of which they're all arbitrary. You can just pick them out of thin air. There's nothing scientifically connected to the goals in this bill. In fact, it's not even empirically, it's not even known whether doing that would have any demonstrable effect on climate change. It's all speculation. So and the cap and trade program would be completely unenforceable, a bureaucratic nightmare. It's not at all as relatively easy to do as the SO2 trading program has been, from which it is sort of adapted. So my feeling personally is that most of what people want out of this bill is already available elsewhere at less cost, and they're saving money as a goal. You could not pass the bill and do a few things with less money elsewhere and put the money into something else.
Charles, any questions? Thank you again for coming. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify at this point? Okay. Yes. Since, well, my one remaining House member is staying here, even though they're on the floor, so if you could keep it pretty concise, it would be helpful.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jeremiah Bauman with Environment Oregon, the new home of Osberg's environmental work. And I'll keep it incredibly brief. Global warming is, I think, one of the biggest problems our state's going to have to face in the near term, and this bill is the first step of the legislature engaging with the governor on coming up with joint plans for doing that. It affects literally every part of Oregon, from the Cascade snowpack that affects our farmers' ability to irrigate, salmon's ability to migrate, and our hydropower generation out to the coast and our forest communities, all of whom are significantly affected by global warming already. And we think this is just the first step, and we would strongly urge passage of the bill.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Okay, with that, I will be closing the public hearing. And for the committee, we do not have a meeting tomorrow. We do have a meeting on Wednesday. I would like to point out we have already had a hearing before on SB 29, and this will be a work session. For those of you that remember this bill, I knew that there were both members who favored the bill and members who opposed this bill. I've worked out a compromise with the co-chairs on the bill, and hopefully we'll have enough votes to make a decision. And with that, we are adjourned.